Hi everyone! After a short break, we're back and we're here with more spooky content than ever. In honor of Halloween coming up, and of course, as I just said, it being spooky season, we're really happy to tell you that we've come up with a really cute little idea that we're excited to share with you. We've titled it our quote-unquote spooky shorts, and it's going to be basically Caroline and I narrating short stories together around two an episode, and we'll be posting two episodes again before our big Halloween episode. Whether it be wicked, weird, or grim, these spooky shorts will center around what we love best, stories that give us goosebumps and leave us wondering. A lot of people have heard the tale of a famous dark rider that comes at night, missing his head, often clutching it in his grasp. Author Washington Irving made this rider famous in American folklore in 1820 with his book, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, spinning the tale of Ichabod Crane and his haunting encounter with who, or perhaps what, we now refer to as the Headless Horseman. The story holds that the horseman was a Hessian trooper who was killed during the Battle of White Plains in 1776 during the American Revolutionary War. He lost his head from being decapitated by an American cannonball, and the exploded bits of his head were left on the battlefield while his comrades hastily carried what was left of his body away. It's said that his regiment eventually buried him in the cemetery of the old Dutch church of Sleepy Hollow. He now rises from his grave as a malevolent spirit, furiously seeking his lost head and wielding a jack-o'-lantern upon his neck in its stead. Modern versions of the story refer to his rides as happening on Halloween, which is actually around the time that the original battle took place. However, the history of this mythic headless being extends far past an 1820 short story. Featuring in Hans Jagenteufel by the Brothers Grimm, and an Arthurian legend as the Green Knight before that, this tale has been around for much longer than a mere 200 years. The roots of the headless figure riding a horse actually seem to stem from Celtic tradition, the headless horseman being called the Gan Cian, meaning without a head in Irish, or the Dullahan, meaning the dark man. It is a member of the Unseelie Court, the malevolent, terrifying court of the Fae that delights in human fear and chaos. It rides a horse black as death, carrying its head under its arm. Its mouth is usually in a hideous grin that touches both sides of its head, with eyes constantly moving about that can see across the countryside even during the darkest nights. The flesh of the head is said to have the same color, consistency, and smell of moldy cheese. The Dullahan is believed to use the spine of a human corpse for a whip, and as the Dullahan is the harbinger of death, the Irish believe that when it stops riding, a person is doomed to die. The Dullahan is said to call out the name of the person, somehow drawing away the soul of his victim through doing so, at which point the individual immediately drops dead. Other times, it is said that he is actually the driver of the Coach a Bawr, a black, silent death coach. It is often claimed to be seen on the Royal Mile of Edinburgh, collecting lost souls. It is said that no door nor gate can stop the Dullahan from achieving his goals of reaping a soul. In fact, it is only a golden item dropped on the path of the Dullahan that will stop him from reaping a soul. It's thought that this has something to do with gold coins offered to the dead, essentially like how gold coins were placed on the eyes of the dead in a lot of ancient burial traditions. However, it's not entirely sure why this works. No one really knows the origins of the Dullahan, nor when, where, or by who it was first mentioned. However, the Dullahan is bound to the mythological and folkloric figure Cromduf, which is thought to stem from the pre-Christian pagan god Crom Crua, the dark god of the burial mound, having domain over both fertility and death. It's said people were sacrificed to him by bashing their heads in with a stone called the Killiklugen stone, their blood scattered about, all in the name of a good harvest and more children. Along came St. Patrick, and with it, the Christianization of Ireland. St. Patrick is said to have cast this god into hell and broken the Killiklugen stone used in sacrifices, and it can now actually be seen on display in Cavan County Museum. With this Christianization of Ireland, much of this god's worship vanished, but still, much of the folklore surrounding this figure continued to live on. The Irish truly feared the Dullahan was still present and culling souls. This god was so deeply entrenched in the folklore and so dark a being that the Irish believed that the Dullahan could never truly perish and would always continue to harvest souls one way or another. If not willingly by sacrifice, then against it with wrath and fury. Thus, the legend of the Dullahan, or the Gan Chian, was born. The region the Dullahan is most often seen are the counties of Sligo and Down in Ireland. In fact, it was in County Down where writer W.J. Fitzpatrick claimed that he spotted the Dullahan and luckily avoided being spotted himself. Does the Dullahan still ride the rolling hills of Ireland and Scotland, seeking souls to reap in replacement for the sacrifices he was denied? Does the Headless Horseman still haunt the streets of Sleepy Hollow, endlessly searching to reunite his head and body? We may never know the truth of the Dullahan or the Headless Horseman, but that won't stop people from seeing them in their daily lives. I'll leave you with two accounts of this horrific, dark creature. The first quote stems from the aforementioned W.J. Fitzpatrick. Quote, "I seen the Dullahan myself, stopping on the brow of the hill between Bryansford and Monyscalp late one evening, just as the sun was setting. It was completely headless, but it held up its own head in its hand, and I heard it call out a name. I put my hand across my ears, in case the name was my own, so I couldn't hear what it said. When I looked again, it was gone. But shortly afterwards, there was a bad car accident on that very hill, and a young man was killed. It had been his name that the Dullahan was calling." End quote. A second account of the Dullahan stems from the county of Galway. Quote, "A man was on his way home one night between Roundstone and Ballyconeely. It was just getting dark, and all of a sudden, he heard the sound of horses' hooves pounding along the road behind him. Looking around, he saw the Dullahan on his charger, hurtling towards him at a fair speed. With a loud shout, he made to run, but the thing came on after him, gaining on him all the time. In truth, it would have overtaken him and carried him away, had he not dropped a gold-headed pin from the folds of his shirt on the road behind him. There was a roar in the air above him, and, when he looked again, the Dullahan was gone."
In the rural county of Talbot, Georgia, lived the Burt family. They were quite wealthy, owning over 300 acres of land and a large family estate. The matriarch of the family, Mildred, had been widowed some years before, and she was pretty devoted to raising her daughters, Sarah and Isabel. Sarah was a social butterfly of the family, and she was engaged to be married. Isabel, however, was the complete opposite. Isabel was shy and socially awkward. She was introverted, and she spent a lot of her time in the family's library. You see, Mildred, at some point in her life, had this really big interest in the supernatural, and so she had acquired all of these books, like stacks of them, on the subject of the supernatural. And she kind of passed that interest on to Isabel. So Isabel would spend hours every day reading these books about the supernatural in the library. Isabel also dealt with a lot of health issues throughout her life, and the main one that she struggled with was insomnia. A local doctor had prescribed her an opium elixir to help her sleep, and she had become addicted to it, but it honestly didn't even always work. So it kind of sucked that she was addicted to this drug, but it didn't even always help her sleep. I kind of feel bad for her. On nights when Isabel was unable to sleep, she would often wander around the estate grounds, despite it being the middle of the night and potentially really cold outside, who knows. It was really common for Mildred to wake up the next morning, find her daughter outside, not having slept a wink. Sarah was engaged to this guy named William Gorman. He was the son of a wealthy landowner who lived really close to the Burts. They were kind of like next door neighbors. One night, William had dinner with the Burt family, and afterwards, he told Mildred, Sarah, and Isabel this really bizarre story. There were these really weird things happening over at his family's estate. Each morning, William went to check on his own flock of sheep. And at least once a week, William found some of his sheep dead. I mean, if you live in a rural area, you know that sometimes livestock die. Sometimes they get killed by other animals. Sometimes they die of natural causes. You know, anything can happen. But this was different. The animals were like torn apart. Like clearly some kind of wild animal attacked them, but The thing was, none of them had been eaten. None of them had been dragged away like they would most of the time if some wild animal got them. They were all right there in their pen, and they were dead, and they were brutally ripped to shreds. William was really freaked out by it, and he started talking to other people in Talbot County, and sure enough, they had experienced the exact same thing. Some had experienced it with sheep, just like William. Some had experienced it with cattle. Some had experienced it with chickens. But it seemed that all of the local farms had lost livestock in this really weird way. One farmer even claimed to have seen a large wolf on his property, and a lot of people started to think that this wolf was responsible. After learning of this, Sarah and Mildred were, you know, rightfully really freaked out. I mean, there's a wolf on the loose that's dangerous, that's like actually attacking people, it's getting pretty close to people's homes. This is not normal. Isabel, on the other hand, was like super fascinated. She just could not get enough of this story. She wanted to hear more. And, you know, it kind of reminded her of the books that she loved to read. It sounded like an unsolved mystery that she would read about. And I can kind of relate, you know, because anytime something like that happens in my own community, I want to know more. I want to learn what's going on. I want to solve the mystery. So I get it. I totally understand where Isabel's coming from here. Or at least, I think I do. Mildred was also really concerned because, you know, Isabel couldn't sleep and she always would go wandering around outside at night all by herself, totally unarmed. So Mildred is now thinking, like, that was already a pretty risky thing to do, but now there's this crazy wolf. Mildred's worst fear was that Isabel would come across the wolf and be attacked just like those sheep. Isabel insisted that there was nothing to fear. She continued to roam the estate grounds at night, and in the daytime, she eagerly awaited news of the wolf. That was pretty much what she was doing those days. She was wandering around at night and waiting on news of the wolf in the day and reading her supernatural books. As the weeks passed, the attacks on livestock continued. Rumors began to circulate throughout Talbot County that these attacks were not normal wolf attacks. These were something different. People were actually saying that this was all caused by a werewolf. William wasn't sure if he believed these rumors. I mean, werewolves, really? But when he eventually organized a hunting party to search for the wolf, he still took the advice of this old man that he knew. This guy was definitely a believer in the whole werewolf theory. The old man told William that if a werewolf was really the one killing the livestock, they had a lot to worry about because the way he knew it, werewolves were people who made a pact with the devil in order to gain the ability to transform into a wolf. And he basically says the best way to get rid of a werewolf is to shoot them with silver bullets. Because silver, if you don't know, is supposed to ward off evil. So he gives William this crucifix that's made out of silver, and he tells him to melt the cross down into bullets and hand them out to this hunting party. So William does that exact thing. He does exactly as the guy says. Before the hunt begins that night, William pays a visit to the Burts. When he tells them that he's headed out on this wolf hunt, Isabel freaks out. I don't mean, oh, I'm worried about you, or oh man, you shouldn't go. I mean, she is like hysterical. She's crying. She's like grabbing William and begging him not to do this, not to go out there. And everyone is really freaked out by this. Mildred actually has to grab Isabel and like carry her out of the room. She's completely freaking out. It's really, really weird and out of character for her. By the time William begins the hunt with the other men a few hours later, he is still thinking about this. He is still thinking about how weird it was that Isabel freaked out like that. It was so out of character. She was shy, reserved, quiet. You know, she never had a meltdown like that. He was so confused and so worried about her. I mean, after all, this is his fiance's sister. He cares about her. Eventually, the hunting party gets going, and William gets his mind off of the things that had happened earlier in the day. And sure enough, the next thing he knows, they spot a shadow between the trees. It's the wolf. William aims his rifle, he fires a shot, and then he hears this loud scream or moan. He can only assume that it's directly from his target, that he's hit the wolf, that he's shot the wolf. William and the other men go to collect their kill, but when they get to the spot where the wolf was standing, or at least where they thought the wolf was standing, there's no wolf. The only thing they find there is a wolf's paw on the ground. It seemed that the shot had only severed the wolf's paw rather than kill the wolf, and that the wolf was still out there somewhere, roaming around in the woods. The hunt continued, but the wolf continued to elude them. The following day, William was visited by a friend, a fellow hunter from the night before. This friend had a pretty weird claim. See, the night before, this guy, he had picked up the wolf's severed paw and taken it home with him. And the next day, that morning, whenever he opened his bag back up and looked at the paw, it was no longer a wolf's paw. It was instead the severed, decaying remains of a human hand. William laughed at his friend. I mean, he's thinking, there is no way that happened. That was definitely a wolf's paw. Surely this guy's kidding, right? But then his friend pulls out a bag and shows him the severed hand. William doesn't know what to believe. He is so positive that last night, that was definitely a wolf's paw. Werewolves couldn't be real, could they? And if they were, why was one in Georgia? Where did it come from? There's just no way, right? William really wanted to talk to Sarah right then and there, because after all, she's probably the person he cares about most in the world, and her sister is like a supernatural fanatic. She loves this stuff. Perhaps she would be able to help him figure this all out. Maybe she would even have something in one of her books that made it all make sense. But when William gets to the Burt estate, he learns that the family had left early that morning and that they had gone to Paris. And, you know, just a reminder, these people are in rural Georgia. Paris, France, that's across the Atlantic Ocean. That's a really, really huge trip to just take randomly like that. William assumed that the Burts would be coming home soon. I mean, they had been to Paris before, so it's not completely ridiculous to think that they might have taken another trip. But it didn't really make sense because he was just at their house the day before and nobody had said anything about going on vacation. Nobody had said anything about going abroad. Nobody had said anything about going anywhere. The family seemed like it was just a normal day, not preparing for anything big. And I mean, surely his fiance would have told him that she was going to Paris. I mean, that's a pretty long way away. She would have been away from him for like weeks this time, right? Like it's the 1800s, it takes a long time to get there. So William is just really confused and he's kind of hurt that Sarah didn't say anything to him, but he just assumes that they'll be back. But then the weeks pass and the Burts don't return. And in fact, he never hears from them again. William is devastated. He can't understand what happened. Why did they leave? Why did this girl that he was going to marry run away to Paris with her family without a trace? Why didn't she ever write him? Why didn't she leave like an address so that he could write to her? And why was the trip so sudden? What had sparked it? What had caused it? What was going on? And it seems like the townspeople in Talbot County, they really wanted answers too. William starts to hear all kinds of rumors. The main one is that it all came back to the night of the wolf hunt, the night before the Burts disappeared. The story went that on the night of the hunt, Mildred found her daughter Isabel's bed empty. After all, Isabel loved to walk around the estate grounds whenever she couldn't sleep. But tonight, Mildred was really worried because she knew that the dark woods were full of hunters. Not only could Isabel like run into the wolf and get attacked, but as dark as the woods are, she could easily get injured or shot accidentally. Mildred decided to go out into the night and find her daughter. It was pretty risky, but a mother's gotta do what a mother's gotta do to protect their kids, right? So she goes out into the woods looking for Isabel. And after a short while, she finally finds her. Isabel is just standing there in this clearing, like just really standing there, like staring off into nothing. It's really bizarre. But she quickly realizes that Isabel has something in her hand, and it doesn't take her long to realize that it's a knife. Mildred is immediately really confused, but before she can even, you know, really think about it, she hears a gunshot. Isabel screams and falls to the ground, and Mildred immediately realizes what happened. Isabel has been shot. It's her worst fear come to life. Mildred rushes to her daughter's side, only to discover that she's hurt pretty badly. Her hand has actually been severed completely by the shot. And so she's like bleeding out in the middle of the woods, in the middle of this clearing, in the middle of the night, So Mildred does the only thing that she can think to do. She just picks Isabel up and carries her home. And so, what is the whole point of this story? Well, the point is, it had been Isabel killing the animals all along. On each of her walks out into the night, she carried a knife. And each night, she killed livestock. Some people believed that Isabel was a real traditional werewolf. Some people said that it was all in her head, that she had some sort of mental illness like lycanthropy that gave her the belief that she really was a wolf rather than a human. And it was all just something that she was doing because she was sick. Some people believed some version of both of these ideas. All the stories had one thing in common, the Burt family disappearing like right after this all goes down. Some people said it was to avoid the scandal, that the Burts ran away to Paris just to avoid all of the gossip and talk that inevitably would plague Isabel's reputation for the rest of her life. Some people thought that maybe they took Isabel off to some kind of hospital in Paris that could treat her mental illness. And some people thought that they were all just trying to hide the fact that Isabel was a werewolf. William never figured out exactly which version was true, and he never really concluded what he believed. After all, he didn't believe in werewolves. He didn't believe in stuff like that. But his friend had shown him a severed human hand, and he was just so sure that the night before he had seen a wolf's paw. He was so confused, and he never got answers. These were questions that he had for the rest of his life. Years passed, and the legend of the Georgia werewolf continued. Nobody heard from the Burts, and nobody ever knew the truth. And then one day, Isabel returned. She spent most of her adult life in Paris with her family, but when her mother died, she inherited the estate in Talbot County, and she decided to come back. She was never embraced by the community, and so nobody ever really found out what happened. Nobody ever got close enough to ask her, and she wasn't really willing to talk anyway. She was constantly the topic of gossip around the county, and really around Georgia, because by this time, her story had spread. She lived in Georgia for the rest of her life, until she passed away in the early 1900s. When Isabella passed away, her story was so memorable to the people in Talbot County that a lot of them didn't even want her to be buried on consecrated ground because they were so sure that she was a werewolf, that she had made a pact with the devil. But eventually the others won out and she was buried in a small cemetery in Talbot County where she grew up and where she lived the last few years of her life. For many years, the cemetery was forgotten and in ruins. But then the story started gaining interest again on the internet, and a local ghost hunting group actually keeps the cemetery and Isabel's grave up today. So now, if you do go to Talbot, Georgia, you can visit her cemetery and you can visit her grave and maybe give her some flowers or something. Maybe just spend some time there with her because I don't think anyone else really does. To this day, Isabel, her grave, and this legend, it's all still a mystery in Georgia. We never found answers, and we probably never will.
Thanks for listening to the spooky short for the week leading up to Halloween. We had a lot of fun recording these short and sweet and deliciously scary stories, and we hope you enjoyed them too. Catch our next spooky short soon. Until then, you can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts, as well as on Instagram and Facebook as @WickedWeirdAndGrim, and on Twitter as @WickedWeirdGrim. Be sure to rate and review us on iTunes, and drop us a voice message on Anchor. Finally, consider joining our Patreon army to support us in continuing to do these tales that we and you all love so much. With that, we'll see you in our next spooky short with the Grimm Sisters. Bye.